Years ago, while researching unidentified persons cases, I came across a woman found in an abandoned Detroit house. She had no identification, no way to know her name. There was just a brief case description and a few known facts. No media outlets were covering her story. I eventually wrote a poem dedicated to her called Detroit and Other Sorrows. It was about her and about the city itself. Years later, after my book Doe was published, I learned she had been identified. Her name was returned to her family, though it was never publicly released. I never sought out her name, respecting her family's privacy, but her story stayed with me because it raised a question I've returned to again and again. Who are the people who do this work in bringing people back to their families? Who spends years trying to identify someone the world has already forgotten? That question eventually led me to Catherine Schweit. Catherine is a former FBI special agent executive, a prosecutor, and a journalist who now hosts the podcast Stop the Killing. But she's also the author of a new book, Women Who Talk to the Dead, which tells the story of women who work to identify Detroit's unknown dead. Today, we're talking about those investigators, the challenges they faced, and what it means to restore a name to someone who has been lost.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Mary Lynn Ricecup.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
And hi to our guest today, Catherine Schweit.
Hi, Amy. Hi, Vanessa.
Vanessa, you're going to kick us off.
Okay. What drew you to tell the story about Shannon Jones, who is a Detroit police detective and FBI special agent Leslie Larson?
What drew me to do this story? Yeah. It's kind of a funny angle on how I ended up doing it. I'm from the FBI, 20 years agent, and I had worked as a prosecutor before that, and I shared an office in Chicago when I was in Chicago as a prosecutor with a woman who handled what we called the dead baby cases. Like, her whole job was to prosecute people who killed kids, and I just always felt like I couldn't do that job. I worked drug cases, and or as we would say, I did drugs. And I can't even imagine what she was doing. She had three little girls of her own, but, you know, she thought it was so important to do. So then years later, I spent time in the FBI, a number of years in the FBI, and not long before my departure from the FBI, I was retired. You get to a certain age and you're mandatory in the FBI. Just before I was mandatory, I got a call from a friend of mine in the FBI. She worked in the Detroit FBI office. I was working in FBI headquarters at the time. And she knew Shannon Jones, a Detroit police detective. This woman's name that I know is Leslie Larson. I knew her as a baby, you know, as we would say, a baby agent, a person who, she got hired right out of college into the FBI. And she's from Wisconsin. And I had been at that time, I was working in the Milwaukee FBI field office. She got hired there to sort mail. And so early on, she and I developed a relationship. I was the terrorism supervisor. It was right before 9/11. And, you know, I kind of mentored her, as it turned out, through her whole career. So fast forward to near the end of my career, Leslie has gone from sorting mail and answering phones to running the third busiest forensics team, evidence collection team in the FBI. Leslie Larson is now an FBI agent working in Detroit, running their 40-member team. And she calls me, her mentor, one of her many, I'm sure she has many, and says, hey, I'm trying to get funding for this project that we're working on with the Detroit Police Department. My friend Shannon Jones has, and she is, as everybody knows about Leslie, she's very casual and she's very calm, no matter what kind of words come out of her mouth. And she says in the process, Shannon Jones is the person responsible for missing persons cases, and her missing persons cases are beginning to cross over cold case murders in their files in Detroit. And so Shannon has come to me, and this is kind of how Leslie says it. She's like, I'm having trouble. I have some questions about funding, and who should I talk to? Because we're trying to dig up 200 bodies in Detroit cemeteries. And she just says it flat. Mm-hmm. What? And I'm like, what? What are you doing? And she's like, yeah, well, Shannon thinks the best way to get, you know, all of these 200 murder victims are unidentified. And so we're just going to go get their DNA. So first of all, I was like, what? There's a lot of what. And once I got past the what and the wow, I thought, well, who knows you're doing this? And she's like, well, we're just doing it because it needs to be done. And I was like, that is a story that needs to be told. Are you kidding me?
Exactly.
That is a story that needs to be told for people to appreciate and understand all the, to me, there were immediately as a writer, there was so much depth to that. There was like, who are these people doing this and why are they doing that? Mm-hmm. And who are the people who were killed and why is nobody looking for them? It's just the whole aspect of missing persons that I think we hear the words missing person, but we don't really think about what those words mean.
Exactly.
And I wanted people to think about what that means.
Yes.
So that's a very long explanation.
No, it's perfect. It's actually the exact way I felt when I read Amy's book of poetry, Doe. I feel like the way you're wording it, story needs to be told. And so I think I feel what you're saying with that. It's just, it does need to be told, right? These are the things that are important. And the story you're telling is definitely one that is worth hearing to understand.
Right. No, yeah. Nobody's looking for these people.
Right.
No one.
Yeah.
And I think that's leads me to my next thought, which is when you say no one's looking for these people, right? The book actually challenges what we think happens when someone's reported missing or there's an unidentified body. And this perception that these cold cases are kind of being worked all the time. And you're confronting the reality of that in this book. And, you know, Shannon and Leslie are doing that on the ground too. And I just wanted you to maybe speak a little to what that reality actually is, because I think we just don't know what happens.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm glad you bring that up because I think that's something that I am asked a lot as I'm out talking about this book, and this probably won't surprise you, but, and maybe it's because it resonates with so many people, but this book's sales are really good because of that. I think there is a realization that so many people initially, they say, well, how can there be that many unidentified people buried in a cemetery? How can there be so, why isn't anyone looking? Everybody has all these questions. Well, what do you mean people aren't looking for them? Or what didn't the family look for them? There's just such misconceptions. And I don't even think it's just misconceptions, right? It's just an incredible ignorance, a lack of information about what does it mean to have people missing and who is really looking for them. So if you go back, these cases that in the book, maybe just from a book summary standpoint, I'll tell you that this book tells the story of 200 unidentified murder victims, people who were killed and then buried in pauper's graves by the Detroit police and other departments, by Wayne County and in the Detroit area. And they are all victims of, there is a murder finding by the coroner's office in every one of them saying this person was killed. And then because once somebody dies, you bury them, right? That's it. Then there's a paper file in the case of Detroit police. And I try to tell the story about Detroit, which we could maybe talk about separately too. But, you know, there's a paper file that says this person died and this is what we know about it. And there's really not a lot of information on that paper file. And some of these cases are, sometimes people say, well, wow, 200 people, like that's a big serial murderer. No, these are 200 separate cases that date back 70 years of missing persons. So say 50 years ago, somebody went missing, what happened to that case? I think that gets to kind of your question.
Yes.
50 years ago, some 25-year-old goes missing. Maybe they are a substance abuser. Maybe they're a woman who walks away from somebody who's beating them. Maybe they're a person who walks away or who gets lost or who drowns in the river after somebody, you know, steals their bag and beats them over the head, things like that. That file, this body is fished out. That file is, once you get a, and I'm going to say this, you know, I spent 20 years in the FBI. once you get to a certain point in a case, if you have no more leads, if you have no more reasons to investigate, no more questions, no many leads, that's what we call them, mm-hmm. then there's nothing else you can do. And that's when the word cold case gets applied to it. It's a cold case. We don't have any more leads to follow. So if you take anything away from this podcast, I would say the most important thing to take away is a recognition that if you have somebody in your family or you know somebody who had somebody missing through the years, and you say, oh, there was a police report filed at some point, and so we know that the police know about it. My answer to that is no, they certainly may have something in a file a long time ago, but the likelihood that somebody is working on it, it's impossible. They're not working on it is what I'm telling you. So please be confident to know, to go back to some police department and say, hey, you know, my uncle went missing X number of years ago. This is his name. This is his information. Here's a picture of him. And can I give you a cheek swab? Because I would like to put my DNA into the missing persons databases in case there's a match. Because if the police have worked a case for a short amount of time and now it's a cold case, they need something new to go on. And something new to go on may be the photograph, it may be fingerprints, but it also can be DNA. And if you can provide DNA, there are databases they can search. And so a cheek swab that gives a database is quick to do, not a blood test. Mm-hmm. And it allows them to, over time, look to so many other places to find that missing person. So think about that is what I would suggest.
Exactly.
Which I think was a tangent. I think I went off on some tangent. But I think the point is that, you know, police have nothing to go on. So when people think they're working a case, they're not. They don't have anything to go on.
I think that that's important because when people make those reports, there's this trust or belief that if the person hasn't been found, then obviously someone's still continuing with it. And most of the solved cases that we've ended up covering have really been family-led efforts to try to get that information out there. So I think that's such a critical point that anyone who has a missing person in their life needs to know.
Right.
Yeah, and I think if somebody's not certain about what to do, for instance, this case is, this is from Detroit. This is important to me because I was born in Detroit. Detroit's my hometown. Mm-hmm. So I've always had that connection. But in Michigan, the state police run missing in Michigan. Other states have similar programs. If you're not sure who to reach out to, you know, that's how you do it. You reach out to some organization. If you're not, or reach out to the police or the county sheriff's office and say, I want to file. And it's okay if they say, we can't find the old case. It doesn't matter. Just file a new missing persons case. And that's one of the things that I learned working on this case. You know, I see it from the inside, from law enforcement side, but for individuals, just go file a new case.
Earlier, you said you were talking specifically about Detroit, and so I'm glad to also hear you're from the Detroit area.
Ooh.
Because I think one of the most interesting things beyond the cases that you're talking about and beyond the investigations that are happening is actually the setting itself. Like, Detroit is its own character in this book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm glad to hear you say that. Thank you. I'm flattered to hear you say that because I wanted Detroit to be its own character in this book because to many people, Detroit is, you know, it's an unknown. They just think of Detroit in a negative vein or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think when I was writing the poem for it, it actually ends with a line from there was an ad with Eminem and he was like, this is Detroit. This is what we do. Yeah. And it was a certain amount of grittiness to Detroit and a certain amount of can-do attitude, right? But also just talking about the city itself and what becomes of it and what the Wayne County actions in terms of files and what happens to the disappearance of files is infuriating.
But in the book, there's like this display of resilience. Like, we will get in there and we're going to get this information before these files are no longer here, right?
Right.
Accessible. So
for our listeners who have not read this part of the book yet, basically Shannon and Leslie are faced with wanting to go get files for missing persons and unsolved murder cases. And as they're doing it, the files are literally being taken from the shelves. They're disappearing, right?
I had worked the whole case. Mm-hmm. I had worked on this from the beginning. Like, this book took me like 6 years to put together because when they decided to dig up these 200 bodies to look for the bones to get the DNA, they had to come up with a plan that ended up being a 5-year dig plan. Mm-hmm. So it took me years to, because I wanted to be with them, because I wanted to write a book that was a narrative where you were, you know, it's a different kind of true crime book, right? But you're with them. And a lot of people say, oh, I love watching Dateline, or I love watching these IDs or these true crime shows. But the true crime shows often, almost always, it seems like, have a huge component of the bad guy.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. this book has nothing about the bad guy. This is the people who, the redemptive efforts on the people from law enforcement and others to try to solve these, and the victims themselves mm-hmm. and their families and survivors. And the idea of for Detroit is, I think, you know, I wanted to show how difficult it is, but how persistent they are, mm-hmm. which really parallels. And I love that you see the parallel. Mm-hmm. It, to me, it very much parallels Detroit.
Yeah.
Because Detroit, during my lifetime, has filed bankruptcy a couple of times. And we moved away from Detroit right before what we would call the 67 riots,
okay.
when the city, a huge amount of the city was burned. It was the most damaged city of the riots that occurred during the 60s, something that a lot of people don't, I always kind of chuckle now about people talking about how frustrated they are with, you know, politics and how the life is so tough now and the challenges with crime. And, you know, I know that I lived through the 60s and 70s, which means I'm old, and crime was double what it was now. I mean, we live in a very, very low crime time period in the United States. It's been going down since the 70s. And Detroit had some of the worst of it. And when the riots occurred in the 60s around the United States, Detroit was the worst city where it happened. And much of the city was burned. And I wanted to describe, I spent a lot of time, you know, in Detroit, kind of revisiting it to describe the scars that they had been through. When you think about scars of battle and how people persist despite that, I wanted people to see that the people in Detroit have that because their city has it, and the city has survived and is strong now. And really, I was just there last weekend. It's fantastic. I'm going in a couple of other weeks to give a big speech. And that city persisted and survived, and the people in it who are alive persisted and survive. It is a very gritty, fun town where nobody says no about anything. Yeah. They just do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that perspective of the city shines through in this book. And so it's interesting as an outsider to see Detroit depicted in this way and the people of Detroit.
Right. It's the grittiness of the area, but then also in the people. And then we're also feeling that particularly in these women that are showing up, you know? So it's just, to me, it was definitely the story of grit, right?
Right.
Yeah.
There's a problem. We're going to solve the problem.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
That's us.
And just Shannon in her section, she's like, we're going to dig up these bodies and we're going to do it before I'm retiring. And there's like such.
But it's also this very casual, this is just what's happening.
Yeah.
Kind of way. Right. And this is what we're doing. And it's just such a great quality. And it's great how you had that come across in this book.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I really wanted to write a story that as a narrative where the reader is with them mm-hmm. and is kind of cheering for them and sad when they're sad about their troubles in getting this done and, you know, feeling the victory and in the victories that they did have.
Exactly. And you have such an interesting career yourself and following this story, right? You've seen a lot more than Vanessa and I have seen mm-hmm. of crime and investigations. So I actually wanted to know what surprised you the most about the obstacles in identifying unidentified persons.
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I spent years as a prosecutor in Chicago and then 20 years in the FBI. So I was always on this side of the wall, right? Mm-hmm. I was always on this side working the cases. And a lot of times, you know, working when nobody saw what you were doing. As an investigator, you know, you're driving from here to here because something bad occurred and you're going to look for the person. And it's kind of a surreal, you know, it's a little bit surreal to realize that you are, like, especially 9/11, right? You can imagine after a bank robbery or after a kidnapping. I worked a big kidnapping up in Wisconsin, and, you know, you stop by a grocery store to pick up a bottle of water, and the people in the grocery store don't know what you're doing.
Exactly.
You're like, oh, I'm doing this, but I'm on my way to interview somebody who I think robbed a bank. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there's kind of that separation. Investigators just do their stuff. So what surprised me the most, kind of as an investigator, but looking a little bit from the other side, mm-hmm. I think is the gravity of how nobody cares. Nobody's looking for these people. Mm-hmm. And nobody's looking to solve these cases. There's no accounting anyplace up on a wall or up on a website or on something on television or on somebody's news stories about, or, you know, Reddit page about, mm-hmm. hey, these are the people that we're looking for who are still missing, and can you help us find them? Nobody's, even if they put that up, nobody would look at it and read it mm-hmm. and do it. No one is looking for these people. And it makes me, I was in, I think probably right after the book was published, I went up to they have an annual meeting in Michigan called Missing in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And they were hosting it at Medina University in Livonia, Michigan, mm-hmm. just west of the city. So halfway between where the Detroit Police Department office is, where Shannon Jones works in her office with all these files around her and faces of people staring back at her, and halfway between there and the cemeteries where these people are buried and nobody knows and cares where they're buried. And at the Missing in Michigan day, mm-hmm. which is similar to what they have all over the United States, right? Yes. It's astonishing when you're there, the reality of you walk into the room and you see 100-some, 200-some people, and they're sitting at tables and they have T-shirts on with their loved ones' photos on them. Do you know where he is? Do you know where she is? People who are living their entire lives waiting for the break to find out where their missing dad, son, uncle, brother, nephew, niece, child went. I think that's, to me, the biggest thing is that I work the cases from the inside, mm-hmm. and we always work as hard as we can to solve everything. But the idea of all the people all the people who are out there, I'm sure they feel like they have no power to do anything to find these people who are missing once they get to a certain point. And they're just hoping somebody else will see the flag they're waving in the air. Mm-hmm. And that was, to me, the most surprising.
It reminds me, in part of the book, I think it's Shannon who is saying that in the instances in when they do identify someone and their family members are informed, everyone's just overjoyed and relieved because the family members have been without answers for so long.
Right, regardless of the outcome.
Exactly.
It's a relief.
They have an answer.
Yeah.
Finally, that solves that kind of emptiness that they've had. And I think just understanding an answer of any sort is just what people are searching for.
I think that's really important. Sometimes I was surprised how many people have said to me, well, you know, I didn't know there were that many people. How are they burying all these dead people and they don't have names and mm-hmm. nobody knows who they are? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try to explain to them, that's just the reality of what happens all over the world, right? Mm-hmm. When somebody dies, we put them in the ground and the families are just kind of left with the answers that they have at mm-hmm. that moment. And that's kind of the end of it.
We've actually covered a few stories in which the unidentified person's remains have been misplaced while in evidence. And we've had people say, that's not possible. Like, that can't be true, that you could misplace someone's remains. Welcome to the reality of what is happening, right?
You know, Devlin Barrett from the New York Times interviewed me here at a bookstore in Washington, D.C. as soon as the book came out, because mm-hmm. New York Times loved the book, which is flattering. And I said to Devlin, he asked me about people working on things. One of the questions that he asked me in this bookstore was about people working on the cases and what people don't understand. And I said, you know, a lot of times in true crime stories mm-hmm. and a lot of times on television, in news stories, you see the sentence that says they exhumed the body and they got the DNA and identified the person. And sometimes that's a clause and actually just a clause in a sentence. Mm-hmm. They exhumed the body to get the DNA, comma, and. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's a clause. Mm-hmm. It makes it sound like it's instantaneous. And he turned to me and he said, I think I've written that in some of my stories. I said, well, that's the point of this book.
We'll be back in a moment.
What does it mean to exhume the bodies and to get the DNA? It's complicated, and mm-hmm. and it's kind of like, I'll give you a comparison. When I see television and movies, I'm always quite entertained about the lack of time element. Mm-hmm. They'll have someone, right? They'll have a person who goes from here to here, or a something that goes before the judge, or it literally physically takes time.
Yeah.
I've worked cases where I have to file an affidavit with the court. I have to write the affidavit. That takes, mm-hmm. that might take half an hour, but then I have to find the court. The courthouse might be an hour away.
Exactly.
I mean, there's all of that that people don't get. Right. And in this case, in the case of missing persons and evidence, it's more complicated than that. We have to go someplace and find it and dig it up. And then if a bone is identified, it's a bone. You go look at a bone and see if you can tell me if it's a dog,
right.
It's a dog's uh-huh. bone or a human bone, and where it is. And if somebody dies and a bone is found in Arizona, mm-hmm. and that bone is chewed on by some animal and picked up, transported a long ways away, somebody picks it up, hands it over to somebody down some, you have no idea where that mm-hmm. comes from. And all they can do is do their best effort on it. And even though, you know, bones are found daily, which sounds weird, but let's just, mm-hmm. just go with me on it. Even though bones are found, you don't run a DNA sample on a bone exactly. just because it costs a lot of money to do that. It costs a lot of time to do that. And police and forensics people are busy working on regular stuff, and mistakes can be made all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that's a failure. One of the things that's always a challenge in, you know, in my profession is the idea that you never make mistakes. But last I heard, you know, the FBI hired from the human race, mm-hmm. right? So do police departments, so do forensics teams. And we're not perfect. We're all flawed, and you do your best. That doesn't mean there isn't sloppy work done and laziness or shortcuts, and those should always be caught and fixed. But mistakes can be made too. And even a forensic anthropologist is making a judgment call mm-hmm. about what they say. They look at a skull and they say, I believe this is a man, when it could be a woman. Mm-hmm. They're still looking at characteristics that they're trained to see, but it's not a perfect science.
Right. I think that's another point that I think that a lot of people who are, you know, true crime listeners or followers miss, which is, you know, you want, or you believe some of those investigation tactics or sciences are exact in some way.
Right.
But
yeah,
the reality of it is very different. And it's just a lot of people just trying their best by these cases, right?
Well, nothing can be exact, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or with the resources that they had at the time, which mm-hmm. have shifted over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing about this book that I wanted to share too, with mm-hmm. true crime fans, with people who have their own family members who are missing, the curious, just people who want a good story, is I'm a big fan of educating a little bit mm-hmm. right along the way in any of the books that I've written. And this is one of them. I want people to appreciate and understand that the depth of challenges in doing this kind of work and the steps that it takes to do this kind of work, down to what it's like to dig bodies up from a cemetery, right? And what it's like to do the forensics work and the analysis on it. So that, say you're a person who has a missing father from years ago, mm-hmm. appreciate and understand all the steps where things could go right and things could go wrong, not by any evil intent, but just by the reality of it. And also to see what's a step that I might be able to look at to see whether or not maybe we're not looking in the right place.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Vanessa and I had talked about before sitting down with you is we had a lot of thoughts on who actually was behind these investigations and these efforts.
Oh, right. So we were really noticing that as far as the identification attempts and the body farm, it seems to be all female led. It's all women that are putting their energy into this. And even though law enforcement is still primarily male, all of these areas that you were talking about seem to be primarily female. And we wanted to kind of know what your thoughts were on that.
Well, so I got a little kickback about every once in a while. I get a little kickback from why I titled the book Women Who Talk to the Dead. But I think it was a well-earned title.
Yeah.
When I spoke initially to Leslie, who I've known for 20 some years, she said she's doing this with Shannon Jones. Mm-hmm. But then when I asked them, not even completely understanding the world of missing persons and trying to figure out the forensics and everything, who else should I talk to? Shannon would say, well, talk to this person, talk to Jody, talk to Mary, talk to every name they gave me was a female. Can you talk to Michelle? Can you talk, well, whoever it was, they were all women. And they turned out to be, you know, five female forensic anthropologists and, you know, female FBI agent, female Detroit detective, female state police officer, female prosecutor who wrote the affidavits for search warrants. Enough people who, as, and it isn't that men didn't work on this. Mm-hmm. There were men, but the leaders in these efforts and the persistence was by women. And I think that you can't ignore that.
Right. Right.
I mean, I had a guy who once said to me at a book fair, he's like, why did you have to point out the fact that there are women doing this? Or, you know, that who cares if it's women or it's men, you know? And I said to him, they go back 70 years. For 70 years, all the fantastic men who have been working in law enforcement in this environment never thought to do this. Mm-hmm. And who's doing it now? Who's volunteering their extra time to do it now?
Yeah,
it's the women. And I'm not saying, oh, women are wonderful. I'm saying this is I live and worked in a male dominated profession. And the men, for whatever reason, didn't think to do this, mm-hmm. but the women did. So I think it's okay to give them credit for that.
Right. And I one of the things we were discussing is like, what I guess would make it so hard for a woman as opposed to a man to just let somebody go unidentified? Like, is there maybe a deeper importance for women to give back those names or to know who those people are?
I think when it all hits the fan, investigators recognize that women bring a different mental and emotional toll to the table. I can get offenders to admit things that men can't get offenders to admit. You know, women are, and it's not, you know, just women, but I think people who have a much stronger ability to sometimes relate to others. And certainly men can do that too. But I think that in general, we think of on the spectrum of gender, people who are more on the female side in the gender world are much more maybe empathetic, and they're much more in tune to recognizing the feelings of other people. And I think that's really kind of where this falls into it. And women, of course, in the gender swing, live in the world of often mom and mother. The idea of not knowing where your own child is, you know, the bond that appears there. And I think women are just, you know, historically trained to be nurturers. Not that men can't be nurturers, but women are historically trained to be that. And they are, you can't separate that in your profession. Mm. And so a woman who's in law enforcement is still going to be potentially more nurturing because that's their nature of who they are.
I mean, this is also something that I discovered when I was writing, you know, my book of poetry, was that there were certain cases where there was a really persistent investigator on the case. And every time it was a woman. And it's just fascinating to me, that persistence, that dedication, that like, I'm going to continue to try to solve this, the tenacity behind
and
these
I think,
women.
Right. And I think sometimes when we talk about those cases, it comes from this special connection that ends up happening where it makes it hard for them to not follow through with with solving that, right? We've talked about that before, where they just see something in this unidentified person or in this missing person's case that they just can't let go of.
Yeah. And it's just so it's fascinating to me to see tenacity, which is such a great word for it.
It is.
The tenacity in the investigators that I found when I was writing my book of poetry, and then just to encounter them and see them again in your book, where they're just, they're not letting this go. Right. And it's also interesting to me, because both the impression that I got of Shannon particularly, but also of Leslie, is they're not expecting fanfare or accolades, right? They're just there doing their job, and that is their job that they want to see.
Yeah, I can't even hardly get Shannon on the phone. She's like, even when I'm there, she kind of like, she's a very quiet person. Mm-hmm. She does her job. And, you know, her entire mission is to do that. If she never talked to a person in the news media, she'd be thrilled, right? And, even though I'm law enforcement, she's law enforcement, you know, talking about herself and talking about this, that's not the point of it, right? But I think that's a good point, though, that they just really want to continue to push to get some answers. And I think you really get a feel when you read the book. I mean, I hope you got a feeling when you read the book about the idea that, and it's not just Shannon, right?
Right.
But around the country, there are people who work tenaciously on things when nobody is even asking them to do
exactly.
it. Exactly. They do it because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That notion that, you know, and this is just what we do, right? Like, this is what we do, is we try to find these answers.
So your book also raises the questions of who gets remembered and who gets allowed to disappear, and these patterns that emerge in cases. So can you kind of speak to that?
Yeah, I think that when I came into this, having not been a person who worked missing persons cases, I had to learn myself. And it's not surprising to me. As I mentioned earlier, you know, I worked a kidnapping case, a very prominent kidnapping case of an 88-year-old woman who was kidnapped by somebody, and her family had money and the kidnapper wanted that. And I think that's kind of indicative of what happens when somebody goes missing. If I think it's not unheard of for us to understand that, especially in this day and age, but, you know, if you go back 70 years, you know, who are police looking for when somebody goes missing? You get a phone call. It's the business owner's daughter is disappeared. The business owner's daughter, the businessman calls the mayor's office. Mm-hmm. It, you know, the chief knows that the football coach's son is missing. Somebody who has something tagged to them that's an identity that seems to be important in society, those are the people we look for first, because those are the people that news stories are created about. But when a person walks away from home or drives away from home, or a person is angry and leaves home when they're arguing with a spouse, but they disappear. And when they just disappear, you know, there's standards for when somebody's missing, whether you look for them. If there isn't any nefarious indications, no indication that someone was physically kidnapped or an injury or something, there is, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, or viewers know, there's a time period. Like, oh, you until it's been, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours, whatever the state law is, we're not even going to look for that person. But if it was a, you know, the head cheerleader, right, who disappeared after a football game and didn't come home, they'd be looking for that head cheerleader that night. But our laws in general, for most people, are we're not going to look for them until a certain amount of time. And then we do, I would say, as an investigator, the case is a lot colder, meaning we don't have as many leads. And so many people who go missing, I think the other part, the other half of the sandwich is that the people who are the family members don't know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. The friends and family members don't know, well, the police are doing this, so we told them, so they're looking for them. And I think that's where for the family members, it ends in the beginning.
Yes.
And then they start putting up posters, you know, that say, this person is missing. Has anybody seen her? Mm-hmm. But there are even just equally a number of times when nobody puts up posters. You know, nobody has time to do that. Nobody has the money to do that. Nobody has the access to a television show, a news show, to say, hey, I'm missing my brother. he left on his car to go someplace last Tuesday, but we haven't seen him. There's no television show. Exactly. There's no news program that you can go to. But if that was the head, you know, and I'm just using football as an example because it's so obvious, right? But like the quarterback for the team, and he got in his car and he drove away to go to a friend's house to go to a party after a game, everybody would be looking for him because it'd be a news story. Mm-hmm. There's no inherent news story in missing people.
Right.
I think that that's one of the patterns that we've continued to see, is just that there is also kind of this expectation that when someone goes missing, that would be a news story, right? Like, obviously it would get coverage, but very often there's just
only certain ones do.
Only certain people do, right? Mm-hmm. And what happens and why that happens is part of what we've been talking about here. People are allowed to go voluntarily step away from their everyday lives.
Right. You can leave, right? You can get your car and leave.
Yeah.
I can get in my car here and I'm in my own place in Virginia. And if I get in my car and I just leave, mm-hmm. there's no sign of forced anything and I disappear. I choose to do that. I can do that. Police are going to go, well, we don't know where she went, but she's an adult and she's allowed to do that.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so sometimes it's just, it's hard. Sometimes I think for people to understand that is also a type of missingness, because perpetrator involved disappearances are always more newsworthy, quote unquote, than someone who is just like, I am stepping out of my situation right now. Right.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, I think that's a great thing to point out. One of the things that I think is a crossover in this book, mm-hmm. Women Who Talk to the Dead, is that exactly that. We think of news stories and true crime stories of just stories about a person who was murdered by a bad guy who did this bad thing. And then eventually the true crime story, we resolve it and we send that guy to jail.
Yes.
Okay. And that's kind of the true crime. This is somebody kills somebody and then there's this follow-up.
Right.
But missing persons, there can be a lot of reasons why somebody is missing, way beyond even the ones that I'm talking about. In my book, these are missing persons who everyone was murdered.
Yes.
But some of those murders could have been fortuitous, right? The walk away, a person who voluntarily walked away from his house, for example, he voluntarily walks away from his house and then he is encountered on the street. And in the process of stealing his wallet, somebody bashes him over the head and kills him. Mm-hmm. So the family members believe he just left. Mm-hmm. But in fact, he didn't. I'll tell your listeners a story mm-hmm. that's not in the book.
Oh.
Because this is an ongoing case. I think one thing that people ask me, I'll caveat it by this. Sometimes people say to me, well, 200 cold case murders. So I'm reading a book about all 200 cold case murders and how they got resolved. And I say, no. You're reading the most incredible story of how it, what it takes to even
exactly
begin to try to solve 200 cold case murders, and in the inside story of what law enforcement and others have to do to try to revive a cold case and then solve it. And they are in the process of solving it, but it takes time, as you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And so some of them are resolved in the book, but many more will continue to be resolved on and on and on. So I capped the book after they finished digging. You know, I decided, okay, I have to stop. I've been working on this book for, you know, 6 years or something. I have to stop it and write the book, final, close it. And then maybe I'll do a follow-up on as they solve the cases, but the digging, I wanted people to see the digging and to understand, I mean, it's not just the digging, but understand what the investigation is. Mm-hmm. But after I kept the book, here's an example of that's similar to what I was just talking about. Leslie calls me and says, we're working this case. I did genetic genealogy. We've identified a victim. Mm-hmm. They got the DNA. They identified the victim. In order to identify the victim, they used genetic genealogy, which Leslie is now certified to do. And that allowed her to use this kind of technical, as I say, like a get the book and read about it, right? Mm-hmm. This technical way that you identify somebody when it's not just a one-to-one DNA match. And because of that, the person who you identify doesn't know that you've identified their family member. Mm. So they go and they knock on the door of this woman, you know, hi, can we talk to you? Are you so-and-so? Yes, I am. Where is your dad? Oh, he's in the back room. He's sick. He's been ill. Can I help you with something? Shannon and Leslie, the people who go to the door say, no, you know, we mean, where's your biological dad? And the woman is in her 30s.
Okay.
She says, my biological dad abandoned my mom when she was 5 months pregnant.
Okay.
They go on to learn that this has framed her life, that she has a mom and her mom remarries and she has a stepdad that she loves to pieces. But the dad who went missing, why did he walk away and abandon them? And that's the word, you know, she uses.
Right.
He abandoned them. Ugh. And she has spent many years of her life thinking about this. She wrote her high school capstone paper about how her dad had abandoned them and what did the mom do wrong? Mm-hmm. Was it because she was pregnant and he didn't want this daughter, this child, and all these things? And so they say, so what happened to your dad? So take it back to her living room. So, hi, where is your biological dad? And she says, he abandoned my mom when she was 5 months pregnant with me. And they say, maybe sit down on the couch. Mm. Let's have a seat. Mm-hmm. And they sit down and they say to her, your dad, I even get emotional when I say this because it's like, so, oh my God. Mm-hmm. They say, your dad who went to work that day was killed by a serial murderer. And he was the 11th victim of a serial murderer who is currently in jail for his death and others. But he was the one victim who wasn't identified. So he was buried in a pauper's grave. And we have exhumed the bodies of all of these murder victims. And he is a murder victim who we have identified now and connected genetically to you.
Oh my God.
And so we wanted you to know this story. And ladies, think about this. They also were able to say, and let me show you where he's buried.
Oh, yeah. That's
to go from living your entire life thinking that you've been abandoned or that your presence in your life is what causes your dad to abandon you.
I'm sure she's going to have some time processing all of that information, but it's amazing that she was able to get that information and that closure.
Yeah, just that devastation of he never wanted to leave our family,
right?
And but then also now she's been given back a place that she can go.
Yeah, so how important and how important is it to tell the story? Mm-hmm. This is why I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. How important is it to tell the story of what these brave and wonderful and tenacious people are doing? Mm-hmm. And for the public, for readers, for people who are missing people, to understand and appreciate the scope of what it takes to do it and how you can never give up. And I think the most important thing for, you know, I asked Leslie, what message did you want in this book? And she said, I want the message to be that we will never forget them.
Yeah.
She very beautifully covered my question there.
We were going to ask you what hope you had for readers to carry with them after finishing the book, but I feel like you just kind of that last story, kind of was a perfect way to wrap that question up,
because it's the work that these women are doing to give back to these families.
I think that is the, you know, that is so much the takeaway of and that I didn't even appreciate and understand when I started on this journey. I was so fascinated by the fact that there's so much detail in the book that is, to me, like incredible details. The fact that Shannon Jones would hang files with faces, pictures with faces and photographs up around her desk and sit with hundreds of them around her face, around her office every day, having them look at her, how persistent and tenacious she was. But I think it really speaks to how, in their mind, giving up was not an option.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're never going to forget that there are people out there. And sometimes outside of law enforcement, we forget that.
Yes.
But
yes.
For Leslie, as she said, the most important thing was that we will never forget.
We'd like to thank Catherine Schweit for being on our podcast. You can find the link to her newest book, Women Who Talk to the Dead, on her website, CatherineSchweit.com. We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Detroit and Other Sorrows, read by Mary Lynn Rice Cub. Mary Lynn Rice Cub is a comedian, actress, and writer best known for playing Chloe on the Fox drama 24 and Gail the Snail from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. This spring, Mary Lynn will co-star in the Netflix series North of North, and she premiered her second hour-long stand-up special, Mary Lynn Rice Cub Road Gig, on YouTube in December. Her book, Fame-ish, My Life on the Edge of Stardom, is a comedic look at Mary Lynn's awkward and endearing missteps on the road to becoming fame-ish.
Detroit and Other Sorrows. Scrappers abandon this house. No copper shine left beneath these walls. Inside, nails laid against a bare mattress of cotton ticking, roach dark with blood. This is how women go missing. Bodies acclimated to the force of wills beyond our own. Later in the night, when the ghost city streets go dark, past houses that used to hold our laughter. The skeleton house grips tight to the street edges, where brush gets tangled in our leavings. It is all that is left in the dusk as our world contracts, pulls back on itself like a wounded thing. There is no cure for how you abandon the city, its body stretching for miles past reckoning.
For more information about our show, please visit shegoesbyjanepodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.